A History of Moral Thought, Lecture 4, Being Good and Being Pious. The Euthyphro.
This lecture is called Being Good and Being Pious. It explores the relationship between ethics and religion. We begin with the little Socratic dialogue called the Euthyphro, which is historically very revolutionary because it challenges not only the existing religion of Socrates' culture, but the very mode of thinking that you find in every religion, namely faith, and replaces it with a new mode of thinking, logical reasoning. This is really what got Socrates in so much trouble with the state of Athens. He was only a man, but a new kind of man, and he didn't teach a new religion, but a new kind of religion. The religion of the pursuit of truth by reason. And the Athenians knew, I think, deep down, that that was a threat to their existing religion, which was irrational and immoral. So the basic issue in this dialogue, the issue that doesn't get explicitly spelled out in so many words, but which is there lurking under the words like a shark under the water, is the conflict between faith and reason, religion and philosophy. In this dialogue, Socrates is on his way to court to be tried, convicted, and executed on the charge of being an atheist, because he cannot honestly profess his belief in any of the gods approved by the state. He was not an atheist, in fact, but a pious agnostic. And he's met by an arrogant young man named Euthyphro, who is also on his way to court, to prosecute his own father for accidentally killing a slave. Socrates is amazed that Euthyphro would do this against his own father, for that was regarded by the Greeks as impious. The concept of piety in ancient cultures was used for two things: respect for the gods and respect for your parents and family. Religion and family have almost always gone very closely together, so much so that the same word, piety, meant the fundamental virtue of religion and the fundamental virtue of respect for family. So Socrates asks Euthyphro why he is doing this apparently impious act, and Euthyphro replies that he is doing it out of piety. So Socrates turns on his typical irony and says, "You must really be an expert on piety to be so sure you're doing the right thing." And Euthyphro says, "Yes, I am." Socrates turns on the second typical feature of his famous Socratic method, the demand for a definition, because if we don't know what we're talking about, we're talking without thinking. The wheel is moving, but the hamster is dead. So Euthyphro defines piety as doing what the gods do, loving what the gods love, willing what the gods will. And since there is a story in the Greek religion about a god who prosecuted his father for murder, Euthyphro thinks he is pious because he is imitating this god. Socrates then asks him whether piety is imitating all the gods, and Euthyphro says yes. "But the gods contradict each other," says Socrates, "according to our religious tales. They fight with each other. So being pious to one god would mean being impious to another god when these two gods disagreed. So the same act would then be both pious and impious at the same time, which is illogical." So Euthyphro has not defined piety. He does not know what it is, and he is not justified in acting as if he did. Euthyphro then amends the definition. Piety is doing what all the gods agree to do. The gods agree about some things, so those things define piety. Now we're getting close to a question that should bother us. We're not polytheists anymore, but the new definition would work for monotheism as well as polytheism. Piety is doing what God wills. Or perhaps we are polytheists. The psychologist Paul Vitz at NYU says that America is the most polytheistic nation in history, for the Greeks worshipped only a few thousand gods, but we worship 260 million. Well, Socrates now asks the key question. Even if all the gods agree, or even if there is only one god, as most of us believe today, is a thing pious or good because the gods will it, or do they will it because it is good? Euthyphro doesn't understand the question at first, but when he does, he answers that a thing is good only because the gods will it. This is what philosophers call the divine command theory of morality. Morality is grounded in the will of God. An act is good only because God commands it, and bad only because God forbids it. If God commanded us to eat our neighbor's ears, that would make ear-eating good. If God did not forbid lying, lying would not be bad. The problem with that is that it makes God arbitrary and a tyrant, and to be obeyed not because he's good, but because he's the boss. Is that what piety is? That's Euthyphro's position. That's been the position of some Christian thinkers, Luther and Calvin and Kierkegaard in Fear and Trembling. In that book, Kierkegaard interprets God's command to Abraham to offer his son Isaac as a human sacrifice, a very shocking story. He interprets this as a teleological suspension of the ethical, that is, a purposive setting aside by God, by divine decree, of morality. Now, morality is knowable by reason, but God is knowable by faith. And Kierkegaard, like all Christians, has a very high conception of faith, but, like some Christians, a rather low conception of human reason. He separates and even opposes reason and faith, and therefore separates and opposes, in this story at least, morality and religion. He argues that the greatest good is religious faith, not moral reason. For if moral reason goes all the way up, if the moral law is absolute, then Abraham, in willing to murder Isaac, was not a hero, but a murderer. I don't personally agree with Kierkegaard here, though I think he was one of the deepest thinkers who ever lived, but I hope you can see his point. If God wills a thing because it is good, that seems to put goodness above God as a standard. And since we know that moral standard by reason, we can then judge God by that standard, as Socrates judged the Greek gods by the standard of rational moral goodness and found them wanting. But the God of the Bible isn't like that. He doesn't do all the shenanigans that the Greek gods do. He can't be judged, even by himself, as we judge ourselves. He doesn't have to make an examination of conscience every night and look at the Ten Commandments on his wall and look at himself in the mirror and say, "I was a good God today." Socrates is really saying something radical and revolutionary in saying that a thing isn't good because the gods command it, but the gods command it because it's good. He is saying that morality is higher than religion, that religions can be judged by moral standards. And since we know morality by reason and religion by faith, he's saying that faiths should be judged by reason rather than reason by faith. So we have this dilemma. Do we put religion above morality or morality above religion? Is God above goodness or is goodness above God? Does God command goodness, or does goodness judge God? The traditional answer is neither. God and goodness are equally absolute, because goodness is God's nature, his essence. Goodness is godness. Add an O to God and you get good. It's neither more nor less than God. Add a zero to any number and you get something that's no more and no less than that number. How then does the tradition interpret the Abraham and Isaac story in Genesis 22, if not in Kierkegaard's way? Well, the traditional interpretation of that story in both Jewish and Christian traditions is that God is teaching Abraham exactly the opposite lesson than the one Kierkegaard thinks, that human sacrifice is wrong, and that this new religion that God is revealing to Abraham will be the first one in history that will be completely moral, and therefore will not have human sacrifice. The lesson comes at the end of the story, where God's angel forbids Abraham to kill Isaac, and God provides a ram instead. The ritual sacrifice of animals was a central part of religious Judaism, especially after Moses and the Passover, until the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And Christians believe that the slaughter of Jesus, the Lamb of God, was the historical fulfillment of that symbolic pattern or type. So Kierkegaard is really ignoring the historical context of the Abraham story, and also the historical difference between Socrates and the Christians like Thomas Aquinas and C.S. Lewis who agree with Socrates. The difference is this. Socrates saw real contradictions between Greek religion and reason. He started the movement of philosophy, which became an alternative to religion, or even an alternative religion, and that grew into the hole left by the dying Greek religion, which was dying because it lacked the two things Socrates' philosophy had. It was irrational and it was immoral. But in the Christian era, we had the opposite relationship between faith and reason, between religion and philosophy. We had a marriage instead of a divorce, a synthesis instead of a contradiction. In Greece, the priests and the philosophers were enemies, and you could even tell which one a man was by his clothing in the street. In the Christian Middle Ages, almost all the philosophers were priests. Kierkegaard is in the minority among Christians in agreeing with Euthyphro rather than Socrates. William of Ockham in the late Middle Ages, and Martin Luther and John Calvin in the Reformation, and people who call themselves fundamentalists today usually believe in the divine command theory, mainly because they all have a rather low conception of human reason. They believe reason is not capable of knowing what the true good is apart from God revealing it and man believing it by faith. But the mainline Christian position, the position of most of the early church fathers, Eastern and Western, and St. Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and Newman and C.S. Lewis and Vatican Councils I and II, is that human reason can know God and can know the good, can know that a thing is good in itself and not just because God commands it, that God commands it because it is good in itself, and that it is good in itself because it is like God. Like God's character, God's nature, God's eternal and unchangeable essence, not because it was commanded by God's will. God could never command anything evil because his commands never contradict his nature, which is good, and which we can know something of at least by our human reason, even without religious faith and divine revelation. Thomas Aquinas puts the relation between religious faith and philosophical reason very clearly. He says there are two kinds of truths. Those we can discover and understand and prove by natural human reason, and those we can know only if God reveals them supernaturally and we believe them. But he says these two sets of truths can never contradict each other. Nothing we can discover by reason can ever contradict anything God has revealed to be believed by faith, because the same God is the author of both. Reason and faith are like two books from the same author, and that author never contradicts himself. What reason discovers or proves, when reason is properly used, is truth, and what faith believes, when it is properly understood, is truth, and truth can never contradict truth. I don't see how anyone could argue against that, unless, of course, you believe that the faith is not true. The same goes for any other religion. If you believe it is true, then you must also believe that no other truth can contradict it. Even though that religion may teach many things that reason could never prove, it couldn't teach anything that reason could disprove. Because if it did, then that would mean that reason had proved those teachings to be false, and you can't honestly believe what you know to be false. I think it was Mark Twain who jokingly defined faith as the art of believing what you know isn't true. I think that's funny only because it's self-contradictory. It's impossible. Now, let's bring Socrates into dialogue with another philosopher, Dostoevsky, who says, "If God does not exist, everything is permissible." Socrates seems to make ethics independent of religion, while Dostoevsky makes ethics dependent on religion. Is this a real contradiction or only an apparent one? And if it is a real one, who's right? The issue is important for our civilization because historically ethics has always been connected with religion. Most people have in fact gotten their ethics mainly from their religion. Since most people do believe in some religion, and one of the aspects of every religion is ethics or morality. Sociologists sometimes describe all religions as having three visible dimensions, some teaching about God or gods or ultimate reality, and some commandments or ideals or codes for moral living, and some liturgy or public worship or prayer or meditation. Creed, code, and cult, or words, works, and worship. But a moral code is one of the parts of every religion. And even though the theologies and the liturgies are very different, the moral codes are not only much more similar, but strikingly similar. This point, that different religions share a common morality, or a nearly common morality, is more surprising than you may think. For the morality they share is not just common sense morality. You could group all the moralities of the world, I think, into three kinds. The lowest kind is a morality of calculated egotism, enlightened self-interest. I won't bash your skull in if you don't bash mine in. That way we both save on the doctor bills. We make a deal, like a business deal, that works for both of us. But if it doesn't work, that morality has no power left. When you think you can get what you want without morality and get away with it, you'll junk that kind of morality, the purely pragmatic kind. A second, higher kind of morality is a morality of justice. Do good deeds because it's the right thing to do. Here, there are moral laws and rules and virtues and obligations and responsibilities that have a claim on you, so that even if you can get away with immorality without being punished, you still ought to be moral just because it's right. It's just. It's fair. In the first morality, the only deterrent is shame, the shame of being caught by someone else, or fear of punishment. In the second morality, the deterrent is guilt, which is not external and public, but internal and individual. But there's a third kind of morality, and that's the highest and the rarest. It tells us that we should go beyond even justice to unselfishness and charity and self-sacrifice and mercy and forgiveness and even martyrdom if necessary. Now, the remarkable thing is that every single one of the major religions of the world teach this third-level morality, as if they all had a peephole through the same curtain and saw something of the same secret. For outside religions, this secret is very rarely seen. In our own society, people who claim to have lost belief in religion still often say they believe in this morality, but most of the time they're remembering it from the religion they once believed, or the religion their family or their culture once believed. Almost nobody ever came up with this third-level morality independent of religion. That's the subjective or psychological or personal connection between morality and religion, how we learned it. There's also an objective or logical or impersonal connection. I mean this, when asked to explain or ground or justify their morality, most people turn to religion. For instance, when asked why we should treat all people as intrinsically valuable, as ends and not as means, when asked why people should be loved rather than used, when asked to justify the moral maxim that we shouldn't use people and love things, but love people and use things, most people in our civilization would say, because we're all God's children, or because we're all created in the image of God, or because we're all loved by God and we should love what God loves. So for most people, religion is the main source of their ethics, and the main ground for their ethics. Now, my question is this. Does that mean that religion is the only psychological source of ethics, or the only logical ground for ethics? Since I'm a philosopher rather than a psychologist, I want to focus on the second question. Is religion the only logical ground or justification for ethics? That's one of the issues raised by Dostoevsky's saying, if God does not exist, everything is permissible. He would say religion is the only ground for ethics. That issue is also raised by Socrates saying that a thing isn't good because the gods will it, but the gods will it because it's good. So he would say, no, religion is not the only ground for ethics. Ethics can be grounded in a rational philosophy. Now, let's put three thinkers in our debate. Dostoevsky, Socrates, and Jean-Paul Sartre. Dostoevsky was a Christian, Sartre was an atheist, and Socrates was an agnostic. He was pious, but he didn't claim to know anything about the god or the gods. An agnostic means one who does not know. Gnosis is the Greek word for knowledge, especially higher knowledge or mysterious knowledge or hidden knowledge. You can remember this if you remember the joke about the dyslexic, agnostic, insomniac who stayed up all night wondering, is there a dog? Let's imagine these three thinkers discussing Dostoevsky's saying, if God does not exist, everything is permissible. Dostoevsky argues, if there's no God, there's no real objective goodness. If there's no God, there's no answer to the simple question, why not be anything I want to be? Any kind of selfish, egotistic pig I want to be, as long as I don't get caught and punished. And since Dostoevsky believed very strongly that not everything is morally permissible, and that we all know that deep down. Therefore, we know that there must be a God, even though some of us don't know that we know it, and we suppress that knowledge because we don't want to know it. Enter the second party to the debate, the atheist Sartre. Dostoevsky put his saying into the mouth of the atheist Ivan Karamazov in The Brothers Karamazov, who is not just a selfish pig, but an honest and moral man, but a flawed man who hates his horrible father and wants to kill him, or wants somebody else to kill him, but God and morality stand in his way. So Ivan has to kill God and morality first in order to kill his father. Freud loved this book. You can see why. The Oedipus complex is right there at the heart of it. Now, Sartre identifies not with Dostoevsky, but with Ivan. He doesn't want to kill anybody, but he does believe there is no God, and that therefore everything is permissible. Nietzsche went through the same reasoning process. The difference was that Sartre says this conclusion filled him with nausea and distress because it meant that life was meaningless. The play is meaningless if there is no author. Nothing justifies our ad libs. There is no higher standard that can judge anything as really good or evil. Nietzsche, on the other hand, found the idea that God was dead exhilarating, because now he thought man can become God, man can become Superman, Overman, the new man without religion and morality, without restraint and conscience. When God dies, man becomes God. But both Sartre and Nietzsche agree with Dostoevsky's saying that if God does not exist, then everything is permissible. They both disagree with Dostoevsky's two other beliefs that both God and morality exist. So for both of them, it's a package deal. Religion and morality, or God and morality, both stand or fall together. Enter Socrates. Socrates disagrees with that common premise that if there is no God, there is no morality. That if God does not exist, nothing can be said to be really wrong. He disagrees with Dostoevsky's saying. It sounds too much like Euthyphro. Actually, though, it's quite different. It's capable of a much broader interpretation. Euthyphro says an act is right or wrong only because the gods will it. So if the gods didn't will it, nothing would be good or evil. Dostoevsky says that if God doesn't exist, nothing would be good or evil. Now, Dostoevsky was not an ancient Greek pagan polytheist, but a Russian Orthodox Christian, so he believed in a single, perfect, intelligent, and moral God, and also that it was God's nature, God's essence, and not just his will, that was the ultimate standard for morality. But whether it's his will or his nature, if there is a God, God must be the ultimate ground and standard for good and evil. Why didn't Socrates clearly see this? Because none of the Greeks came up with the idea that God created us and the whole universe out of nothing. That was a distinctively Jewish idea. It is he that has made us and not we ourselves. If that's true of our being, it must be also true of our goodness. For our goodness is the fulfillment of our being. Now let's bring another philosopher into our conversation. This will seem at first to complicate things, but in the end I hope it will clarify things. The philosopher is Albert Camus. He is also an atheist, and his most haunting character, I think, is the heroic Dr. Roux in his novel The Plague. The good doctor risks his life to save the life of plague victims, and he asks himself why he's doing this, and he answers that it's because he knows he has to be a saint. He has to be a moral hero. The Catholic writer Léon Blois, the 19th century Frenchman, said, "There is only one tragedy in the end, not to have been a saint." Camus was not a Catholic, but an atheist, but he would agree with that saying. He believed in morality, even though he didn't believe in religion, or in God as morality's origin, or in heaven as its reward. So his hero, Dr. Roux, agonizes over this dilemma. He believes three things, and these three things can't logically all be true. If any two of them are true, the third one has to be false. First, the meaning of life is to be a saint. We must all be saints. Second, you can't be a saint without God. Third, there is no God. Camus never solved that problem. Logically, there are four possible reactions to Dostoevsky's saying that if there's no God, there's no real morality. First, you could say that the saying is true, and that there is no God, and therefore no real morality. That's Nietzsche and Sartre. Second, you can say that the saying is true, and there is a God and a real morality, and that's the position of Christianity and Judaism and Islam. Third, you could say that there is no God, but there is a morality anyway. That seems to be Plato's position. Morality itself is the absolute. The abstract idea of goodness is superior to all the gods, at least all the gods that Plato knew, the gods of Greece. So Plato would not agree with Dostoevsky that if there is no God, there can be no morality. Socrates, unlike Plato, seems to have believed in a single perfect God, whom he never names and never claims to know anything about, and he never tells us what is the connection, if any, between this God and morality. He never tells us because he didn't know, and he knew that he didn't know. That was Socrates' wisdom. The fourth possible attitude towards Dostoevsky's saying is this. You could say that God does exist, the perfectly moral God exists, but nevertheless everything is permissible, that God makes no difference to morality. That doesn't sound like a very reasonable position, but maybe it's a very popular one. Maybe there are people who take that position. Maybe millions of Americans take that position. They don't want to be atheists. They want the comfort of believing in a God, in fact, in a God of love, but they don't want to be saints either. And they don't want to feel guilty about anything, especially about something that they very much want to do, that they find very exciting and enjoyable. And so they use pop psychology and condemn traditional morality as repressive and judgmental, and judge morality for being judgmental, and tolerate only tolerance, but they're intolerant of intolerance, and they're dogmatically opposed to dogma, and absolutely opposed to absolutes, and they say it's true, there is no truth. Well, I think Socrates would probably say to that something like this. That's one of the great things philosophy can do. It can show what a fool you are, and that's the beginning of wisdom. Philosophy can make you very uncomfortable. Believers in God use Dostoevsky's saying to make an argument out of it. It's called the moral argument for God. This would be their answer to Camus' dilemma. The argument is that since not everything is permissible, God must exist. The existence of a real morality, a real distinction between good and evil, cannot be explained without something like God. That argument presupposes the premise that good and evil are objectively real. Many people say they don't believe that premise. They say morality is man-made and subjective and relative, like the rules of a game or like politics. But when you ask these people whether they really believe that it's okay to rape or to be a Hitler or a cannibal or even to burn down the rainforests, they don't say then that morality is only subjective. When they tell you not to impose your morality on them, suppose you tell them that's your morality. But imposing morality on other people, that's my morality. And tell them not to impose their morality of tolerance and respect and justice on you. And if you tell them that, you'll soon see whether they're really moral relativists or not. You'll find out that there are only selective relativists, that pretty much the only things they're relativistic about have something to do with sex. That sounds silly and simplistic to say, and I feel a little bit like the little boy in the emperor's new clothes for saying it. I don't say it in order to be provocative. I say it because it seems to be true. But we'll look at that issue in our last lecture. The moral argument for God asks, if there is a real morality, where does it come from? From a godless universe that's made up of only blind atoms and chance? How do you get a real good and evil from nothing but molecules and kinetic energy and rearrangements of quanta of force? And if conscience is not the voice of God, but only the voice of your parents or your society or your animal instincts or your genes, then why do we all believe that it's always wrong to disobey your own conscience, to deliberately do something you honestly believe is evil? Even moral relativists believe that. They may say different strokes for different folks, and what's good for you is only good for you and not for me, and don't impose your morality on me, but they always have one absolute left. If you sincerely believe that it's wrong for you to do something, you shouldn't do it. It might be all right to sin against society, against religion, against traditional morality, against the Ten Commandments, but it's never right to sin against your own conscience. Well, why, for goodness sake? Why treat your conscience as if it were a prophet with divine authority? Unless it is. Thus, we have the argument from conscience for the existence of God. The argument says God is the only hypothesis that explains the data. The data is the absolute authority of conscience. But neither society, nor instinct, nor genes, nor parents, nor anything else except God, or at least something God-like, something absolute, has that authority. Therefore, there must be some absolute good. We began this lecture by looking at Socrates' substitution of rational philosophy for religion, and we ended it with an argument from rational philosophy for religion. Are you confused now? Good. I think I will confuse you a little more by saying that I think Socrates would have liked that argument. Perhaps you agree, perhaps you disagree. You have to answer back. Next time, we'll look at the most famous book in the entire history of philosophy, written by Socrates' great disciple Plato, The Republic. As everyone knows, it's about politics, but it's first of all about ethics, and it's Plato's attempt to prove conclusively that virtue always makes you happy.
After listening to Lecture 4, a student posed this question to Professor Kraft. Does morality need to have a God as a foundation? Let's listen to the professor's response.
I think if there is a God who is absolutely good, he has to be the ultimate foundation for morality, ontologically, in objective fact. But he doesn't have to be that psychologically in your mind. You can know that there's an absolute morality without tracing it back to an absolute God, just as you could know that there are universal laws of physical science without tracing it back to the divine mind that designed and created the universe.
This ends Lecture 4. Remember to visit this course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll find additional information about the lectures that you just heard.